This is Wine, Women, and Revolution with your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. And welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution. I'm your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. You can find us online at www.njrevolutionradio.com. Follow us on all the social medias and get us wherever you get your podcasts from. Tonight is going to be a second part of a conversation about modern monetary theory. For those of you that managed to tune in before and hear Professor Mike Merrill's episode, he very much approached it from a scholarly, philosophical sort of standpoint. But there's a lot of emotion that's in, you know, you could bring into a discussion about modern monetary theory. And for many people, this is a very much a passion and almost a life-changing sort of way of thinking about things. So I'd like to welcome to the show tonight, Mr. Jeff Ginter. Welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for asking me.
So people may know you online from Real Progressives, in which you're definitely one of the advocates for modern monetary theory.
Oh, big time.
My first question I wanted to ask you is, what is it about it that makes you so passionate? When you heard this, what struck you? And you're like, this is the thing.
It's to me, in many respects, and I don't want to buy into the idea that MMT is the magic bullet or anything like that, but what it feels like to me when I think about it, when I think about how I came about to understand it, if you were to imagine that you have been poisoned, you know, and you are going to die and it is imminent, and then someone comes along and gives you an antidote, how do you feel about that antidote? Are you ambiguous? Are you ambivalent? Do you not really care? Oh, fine, I'll take the antidote, but big whoop. No, you love that antidote because it's going to save your life. That's how I feel about modern monetary theory. Now, having said that, that's how I feel about it, but there is a big caveat there. People ask me all the time, especially when I talk about modern monetary theory, what it is and what that means for the policies that we can enact. People will say to me things like, wow, this is great. MMT will save us. And I just shake my head and I sigh and I say, no, MMT will not save us. You are going to save us. You and 360 million of your friends are going to save us. It is modern monetary theory that is the antidote to the neoliberalism that we have been experiencing for 47 years. It is through that antidote that we will be able to, if we choose to, save the world, allow ourselves to live and to thrive, and to be able to give unto our children and our grandchildren that which we never had, a future. That's what modern monetary theory is to me.
It's definitely powerful tools when you start thinking about it. Like, anyone that's ever listened to my show knows that I'm an environmentalist. I'm one of those people that keeps telling you we have 10 years to get off fossil fuels, or we all go.
If we're lucky.
Yeah.
If we're lucky, we have 10 years. If we're lucky.
Whenever I bring this up, you invariably get the question, but how are you going to pay for it?
Absolutely. That's the big question. And if
aside
it was up
from,
to
you know, the not dying, there's a financial cost to letting catastrophic climate change.
Well, of course.
But aside from that,
it's not even a fair question. it's not a stupid question. It is a fair question, but it really depends in terms of to whatever degree it's a ludicrous question. It's going to depend upon how you understand economics. Do you understand your personal financial economics, or do you actually understand federal economics? If you think one and the other are the same, then yes, asking how are you going to pay for it is a big, important question, and it must be answered accurately and correctly. And you know, it can be really expensive, and that's going to be scary. But if you understand that the federal economy bears no resemblance whatsoever to your own personal economy, then things get much less scary. You know, then you start to understand that it's not financing a Green New Deal that's scary. It's not having the Green New Deal at all. That is terrifying. It's not how you're going to pay for Medicare for All. That's terrifying. It's the fact that we don't have it right now, that we've never had it, that people are dropping dead by the hundreds of thousands every year because we don't have it. Those are scary scenarios. How are you going to finance it if it's the federal government that does it? That's not scary if you understand modern monetary theory. If you don't, then you may as well ask, well, why doesn't Connecticut do its own Medicare? Well, it can, but it uses currency. It doesn't issue currency. Taxing and borrowing is a big deal to a state or a municipality. Floating bonds that you're going to have to pay back is a big deal for, you know, corporations and states and municipalities and individuals. It's not the same thing at the federal level. It's not that we don't have limitations and restrictions. They just are not the same limitations and restrictions that you and I have. So understanding the difference is critical. And I don't use that term lightly. I mean it seriously. It's critical. It is life or death.
All right. So let's strip it down and explain it for people who don't quite yet understand it or have heard it and were turned off by it and the, you know, how it was delivered to them. Let's start from the very basics of what is currency.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of things that I want to say first about modern monetary theory before we get into the weeds. To my way of thinking, there are two aspects of modern monetary theory. There is what it is. And then there are those that understand modern monetary theory. There are the policy prescriptions that they now have in mind, you know, and people conflate one and the other. A good friend of mine, Christian Riley, he does the MMT podcast with Patricia Pino. I can't overemphasize how important this particular podcast is. It's right up there with Macro and Cheese, with Real Progressives, and, you know, all manner of others, you know, that are out there. Very important pieces of work if you really want to understand this stuff from the layman's perspective. A Christian, you know, wrote a manifesto for those who will talk about MMT. And I love this document. I love the man. But in it, he, you know, is really talking about the activist side of modern monetary theory, which is very important. But there is also the strict definition of modern monetary theory. Modern monetary theory as a definition is simply an explanation of currency. It tells you how currency is created, how it circulates through the economy, and where it goes to die, where it goes to meet its maker. That's it. Once you understand how that functions, you suddenly realize that we have a lot of policy space that we could do. We are not financially restricted. We are resource restricted. And I'll explain more about that in a moment. But it's with that understanding that we say now we want to have a Green New Deal. We want to get off fossil fuels. That's going to be expensive, they will say. We want to get Medicare for All. Well, that's going to be expensive, they'll say. And a federal job guarantee. And there's all manner of things that those who understand modern monetary theory and are activists in favor of it, we do have things we want to be able to do with this knowledge. But the important thing to remember is that MMT, strictly speaking, describes currency. As a result, MMT is in operation right now. It's not something we need to adopt as a definition. MMT describes currency, and it describes it in the Eurozone of Europe. It describes it here. It describes fiat currency. It describes the gold standard. It describes all of it. That's why when people say, when I tell them about modern monetary, they say, well, my God, this will save us. I say, no, it won't. If modern monetary theory, the definition, was going to save us, we would be saved already. The reason Donald Trump was able to pass his tax cuts and no one died is because modern monetary theory is real. The reason everyone has been able to create increasing numbers of deficits and deficits and deficits and increasing the debt is because modern monetary theory is real. And we're not saved, are we? We don't have, you know, single-payer healthcare. We don't have a federal jobs guarantee. We still have economic disparities of that of a kind that has not been seen since the 1920s. You know, so a modern monetary theory won't save us because modern monetary theory is simply a definition. The prescriptive side, the activist side, will save us if people get involved. You need to get involved. You need to start fighting. You need to roll up your sleeves. And if you understand macroeconomics, not a monetary theory, you will be liberated, because you will no longer allow yourself to be kowtowed by Democrats and Republicans and pundits on Fox and CNN and MSNBC, all of whom are telling you to be afraid of debts and deficits. They want you to be afraid. They want to turn your bowels into water so that you will sit down and do nothing while they run the show. You tell me, how is it going with them running the show? How are you feeling? Are you feeling economically secure? Do you feel like you can just go up and bask in this freedom that you have, that the Republicans are telling us that we should all have? Meanwhile, we just had a government shutdown, the result of which turned government employees one bad paycheck away from not being able to afford their own insulin. One bad paycheck away from not knowing where their next meal was going to come from. About to lose everything because of one paycheck. They were already feeling that. They lost two paychecks, and they're still looking down the barrel of losing another one. I don't feel particularly saved. You know?
No, definitely not.
It's going to take all of us. But if all of us believe that everything is expensive, that your tax dollars are going to be needed to be able to finance anything that the federal government wants to do, then suddenly a program that is designed to be able to save everyone, life-saving policy like Medicare for All, like a federal job guarantee, you know, like getting us off fossil fuels and going 100% green energy, so I don't know, we could maybe live, you know, all these things that everyone would turn around and objectively say, that would be wonderful. But then they see the sticker cost, how much it's going to cost. And suddenly they get scared and they sit down and go, well, it'd be great. I'd love to go to Disneyland every goddamn day and then end the day by going to Universal. And then, oh, my God, let's go to Paris. That would be great. But I don't even make minimum wage. I don't make enough to be able to feed my family right now. I can't afford the taxes that I pay right now. And you're proposing things that, while they may be great, I won't be able to afford. That's exactly what oligarchy wants you to think. They need you to think that so that you won't fight, so that you will think that it's a great idea, but it's pointless. It'll never happen. So you won't even fight for it. Because the oligarchs know that if we all fought for it, if we all stood up and said no more, we do need these things. We need it badly. And they'll get it. That's why the oligarchs fight. That's why the oligarchs tell us these lies, so that we won't. So what is modern monetary theory? What is currency?
Style, like Republicans and Democrats sure. keep telling you we're bankrupt as a country. We're yes. out of money. We're borrowing against our children's future.
Absolutely. You know,
it's I'm immoral. Sure everyone has heard this again and again and again.
Of course. Yes. I've got a video that I'm making that shows exactly that. Stephanie Kelton shows another little brief snippet of that, where she does, you know, take after take after take of politician and pundits alike, all saying the same things. The debt and the deficit are unsustainable. Join us in, you know, slashing the deficit. You know, we're going to be bankrupting our children's future. You know, it's all scaremongering. It's all bullshit. I can say bullshit on this thing, right?
You can say whatever you'd like.
Whatever I like.
Curse, actually.
Well, fuck it, I will. So
they're all just lying to us, in essence.
Completely. Not in essence. In they're the most blatantly outrageous, plain-spoken, yes, they are lying to us. And we can talk about why in a minute. But you know, all the hows and whys fill in the gaps a little bit, but none of them change the facts of what currency is. So what is currency? Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution of the United States of America says a lot of different things. And for everyone listening, I urge you, read the Constitution. There is a lot of information there that you desperately need if you want to be able to retain even a semblance of democracy, let alone fortify what our democracy was always supposed to be, let alone, I don't know, maybe even make it better and stronger for the next generation. you have to be able to understand at least the basics of the rules. And I'm here to tell you, it's not that long a document. You can buy in paperback form. I mean, I'm talking like that thick. You know, there's barely space between my fingers as I demonstrate this for all you audiophiles. You know, the paperback version of the Constitution that I have, incredibly thin, and it contains a lot of information beyond just simply the contents of it. So read the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, amongst the variety of things that even that small section says three very important things about U.S. currency. One, Congress shall create the currency. Right there, that is a law that says that Congress and only Congress can create currency. No one else can. I guarantee you, you try to make U.S. dollars, you get caught, you will go to jail. I'll see you in 20 years. So you can't create U.S. currency. I can't create U.S. currency. Corporations don't make it. I guarantee you, China does not make U.S. currency. Only Congress. What banks do is something else. Banks are licensed by the federal government to make loans. We'll talk about that in a second. But only the federal government makes currency, makes the U.S. dollar. They gave themselves that exclusive right when they made the Constitution. Number two, they shall tell you what a dollar is worth. So we used to say that a dollar is going to be worth a certain amount of gold, for example. This is the gold standard. You know, so a U.S. dollar, if you take that to the Federal Reserve, they would have exchanged that for however much gold they promised to exchange it for. We don't do that anymore. We haven't exchanged dollars for gold since 1973. Nixon took us off the gold standard in 71, thought he was going to replace it with something, didn't happen. By 73, we were doing fiat currency. I'll explain that in a minute. But that's the second thing. Remember, it creates the currency. And it tells you how much that currency is worth. It tells you how much it's worth. You don't tell it. It tells you. And number three, it shall levy taxes and fines and tithes and all manner of coercive manner to make you need that dollar. So you owe a tax in U.S. dollars. It's either a property tax, or it's a tax on your income, or it's a tax on a dividend, or it's a tax every time you spend something in a store. You are paying taxes all the time. And you can't pay for those taxes in anything other than what the federal government will accept. And it only accepts U.S. dollars. What does this mean? It means you now need U.S. dollars. You will not accept a job for anything that doesn't pay U.S. dollars. If you run a store, you will not accept anything in exchange for your goods and services in anything other than U.S. dollars. Why? Because you owe taxes, and they're denominated in that currency, U.S. dollars. So unless you already have enough money to guarantee that you have, you know, sufficient currency to pay your taxes, if you want to, after that point, accept things in British pounds or the euro, fine, that's your choice. But that's after you have met your tax obligations. So everyone now needs U.S. dollars. Everyone, even the homeless that have no property to tax, have no income to tax, and no personal possessions, even they need U.S. dollars every time they want to be able to buy liquor or buy a sandwich. They don't go begging, and when they are given U.S. dollars, they say, what the fuck is this? I don't want U.S. dollars. Yes, they do, because they want to be able to spend. So that's the first thing to understand about currency. You have to understand who creates it. It's not your boss. It's not a corporation. It's not a bank. It is the Congress. The Congress is, as my friend Jeff Epstein says, the god of the U.S. dollar. From the that is basically what currency is. It is the Congress's ability to create an otherwise useless piece of paper and make it valuable because you now need it for taxes. Stephanie Kelton, do you know Stephanie Kelton?
No, I do not.
Oh, you are in for a treat. Stephanie Kelton is a professor at Stony Brook University. She was the head economist for the Senate Democrats. She was an advisor for the Bernie Sanders campaign, and she is one of the core creators, I guess, of modern monetary theory. She is, in my opinion, the greatest accessible explainer of modern monetary theory. So by all means, look her up. But she tells a story. Her husband is a historian, so she sees it from a historical perspective. She tells a story to explain why this is true by talking about England colonizing Africa. So imagine, you know, you are Africa, and here comes England and lands on your shores and say, man, Africa, you got a lot of great stuff. I love it. I need it. I need it. You know, I need, I want to get some of this stuff back to the homeland. I need you to dig it up out of the ground. I need you to do all this stuff for me. And the African is saying, okay, well, all right, that's fine. England says, and I'm going to pay you for it. And Africa says, okay, what are you going to pay us with? They say, we're going to pay you with the English pound. Holds out, you know, a useless piece of paper. And the Africans are going, what the fuck is that? You know, I'm not accepting payment of that. I can't use anything for that. You know, I'm doing my own thing over here. Thank you very much. I don't need you. Well, England says, well, actually, I'm colonizing you. So every year, I'm going to be charging you a tax. And if you don't pay it, I'm going to garnish your wages. If you don't have any wages, I'm going to confiscate all your property. If you don't have any property, I'm going to throw you in prison. One way or the other, you're going to be punished if you don't pay me the tax. And you're only going to be able to pay that tax in this useless piece of paper, the English pound. Well, you know, you are African, you're seeing all these warships out there, and you realize you're about to be decimated if you don't do what you're told to do. Now, suddenly, you're quite willing to work for the English pound because it's the only way to get you to not go to prison. The great thing about that, I can't believe I just said that, talking about colonizing Africa, the great thing about that, but the interesting thing about that is what used to be a useless piece of paper now suddenly carries a tremendous value. Suddenly you need the English pound in this particular case. You need it because your, you know, colonial masters who colonized you, now we are imposing a tax. And you now need to have that currency in order to satisfy that tax. If you don't have it, you are punished. It is coercive and it is pretty god-awful in its punitive damages. So you now need to work for it. And the only one you can get that from is the government. The government is the only one that creates it. They're the only ones that can get it to you. So you are now going to work for the government. You are going to build those roads, and you're going to dig those mines, and you're going to build those schools and those hospitals and all the things that government needs to provision itself, you will now work for, and they will pay you. And if they're not assholes, they'll pay you well. And you'll now have sufficient currency to be able to pay your taxes, and you'll have enough left over. What are you going to do with that stuff that's left over? Well, everyone needs taxes. Everyone. You know, and not everyone in your, you know, in your economy is going to have a government contract. So just think about that. Everyone now owes a tax, but not everyone gets a government contract because the government's only going to hire so many people.
And so if you have a government, the government actually creates the money and gets it into circulation is
that's by exactly
hiring people.
Hiring people. They create the currency. They impose a tax, guaranteeing that you will need that currency. And then they will pay you in that currency. And now that money will circulate through the economy because everyone owes the tax, but not everyone has a government contract. So many of those people who are now unemployed, used to live off the land quite happily, now need a job that pays in US dollars. They can't get it from the government because they either don't contain a skill that the government needs, and or the government already has all the contracts they need fulfilled. And even though you have a, you know, a competing skill, I'm sorry, there's too many of you. But now the government has created unemployment. By enforcing a tax, they have created unemployed people. Not unemployable people. They created unemployed people. So now these people who are unemployed are now going to be able to try to find work. They're going to try to find work with these people that do have government contracts, or they'll be able to maybe set up a business that'll be good in their community, you know, and they will charge in that currency so they can pay their taxes. But one way or the other, they need to get their hands on that currency. That makes it valuable. That makes the currency valuable. So when people ask me, how much is a US dollar worth? I say, it's worth $1. It's not worth gold. It's not worth paper clips. It's not worth anything. It's worth $1. And its value is derived from the fact that you needed it to be able to pay your, pay your taxes.
So is that the only thing that taxes does is create demand for the dollar?
No, that's the first and most important thing. But what's interesting about this is that now you have cash. If the federal government spends enough, everyone has enough cash to be able to pay their taxes, and they'll have enough cash left over to save and to spend. And they will spend it because they do want goods and services for themselves as well. You know, you're going to go to a restaurant, you're going to go to a movie, you're going to be able to buy clothes, you're going to be able to do all these things. And all these people will accept your currency that you earned. They'll accept it. Why? Because they know that the government will accept that currency in exchange for their taxes. So the currency is really just a tax credit. The government spends it with the promise that they will accept it back in exchange for your taxes. Now the government has created a currency that has value. You all want it, you all demand it, which allows the government to spend. It is the very act of taxing, making you need it, that allows the government to spend it, and you will accept it as payment because the government is promising to take it back. Okay? So now we have currency in circulation. Now it's running through the circulatory system of the economy. And now, when the government has determined that it wants to be able to collect its tax, however much it needs, you know, it will take that money back, and it is now deleted. It is destroyed. Remember the logic of this. The government created the tax in the first place. Why do they need your taxes as revenue to be able to spend it back again? From a purely functional standpoint, just think of the logic of that. It created the currency as outlined in Article 1, Section 8. Anyone can look it up. It's very easily accessible. It creates the currency. If it creates the currency, and the only reason you all are accepting it is because the federal government is, you know, telling you that if you don't pay your taxes in that currency, you get to go to jail, then why does it need that tax to be utilized as revenue? It doesn't. It absolutely doesn't. Not off of the gold standard. And we'll explain the gold standard in just a moment. So you ask, is this the only reason that it taxes? No, it's not the only reason it taxes. Okay? The second and most important reason why it taxes is to be able to combat inflation. If fighting inflation through taxation is one of many, many tools in a government's arsenal. It's just one. But it is the second most important reason why a government will tax. So imagine this. First, to understand what inflation is when the cost of everything in the economy rises over time. Okay? So there's always inflation built into the economy. The central banks all over the world are trying to inflate, you know, the economy, usually at around 2% per year. You know, they're trying to hit an inflation target. They want things to go up a little bit. It's an incentive for people to not to sit on their money, you know, for rich people not to sit on it, spend some of it. It's an incentive. But if the government doesn't tax, if all it does is spend into the economy, you know, first, if it doesn't tax at all, it loses control of the currency. Remember, the only reason you were using in the first place is because you own a tax. So you're going to have a tax somehow. Even if the government only taxes you $10, you know, it's got to tax you somehow. You know, unless you're dirt poor and it's, you know, giving you a complete tax holiday because you make almost nothing, you know, you still need that currency because everywhere you want to spend that money, they need to pay their taxes. So it's only going to be in US dollars. So it can't tax you nothing, or at least it can't tax nothing for the whole population. But if all it did was spend, and now everyone is just flush with cash, and cash is now the only way we get to utilize real resources, the only reason we get to buy food and have food in our bellies and clothes on our back. Everyone has cash and everyone is spending it. Eventually, we're going to have costs go up. You know, we're going to have a real inflation problem. How much of an inflation problem is relative? You know, if you are Apple, for example, and everyone wants an iPhone, and everyone has money for an iPhone, not just the desire to have an iPhone, but the desire and the means to purchase it. If I walk into an Apple store and I got nothing in my pockets, and I really want to have an iPhone, no big deal. You know, I don't have the ability to buy it. I'll want it. I'll walk in. I'll look nice and I'll walk out. Apple has made no sale. But if I walk in and I put money on the table, boom, I want to buy that iPhone. Now Apple now has demand. I have demanded an iPhone and I have the ability to pay for it. They need to produce it. So if everyone comes in, because the government's been spending all this money and it's not taxing very much, if at all, everyone's got money, everyone wants an iPhone. If Apple can increase its production to meet the demands that the population is placing on it, then we don't have an inflation problem because we had enough real resources. You know, was Apple able to dig up out of the ground all the components? Did it have all the idle labor to be able to assemble all that stuff? Did it have the labor, you know, to build the stores and have the sales staff? If it had everything it needed to match production with demand, we don't have inflation. Once there's too much demand and Apple can no longer meet the demand because it can't ramp up its production, then the cost of the iPhone will go up. So imagine this on a scale for the entire economy. Individual prices going up are pretty complicated. You know, just look at the cost of insulin, for example, going up 300,000% over the last several years.
Right, that was not inflation.
Of course, because they realized they could get away with it. There's all manner of reasons, from the ultimately disgustingly greedy to the actual, you know, dearth of real resources to produce. There's all manner of reasons why costs go up. So we got to be careful about what kind of inflation we're talking about. You know, but when prices across a spectrum of the economy all are going up, that's inflation. You know, and then we need to understand, is it, you know, steady inflation, creeping inflation, galloping, hyperinflation? There's all manner of causes and there's all manner of types. So it's very important to understand what inflation is before you start losing your brain about, oh my God, inflation, inflation, inflation. A lot to think about, a lot to unpack. You know, and people who like to push back against modern monetary theory believe that those of us who are activists, and they actually espouse the economists, you know, the academics, you know, they say that they don't address inflation either. It's bullshit. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. It's difficult to impart in 140 characters on Twitter, but we do. So, if the government just spends, there is a chance, there is a risk that there will be inflation. One of the things the government can do, because we understand that as a consequence of money creation, the inflation risk of money creation can be offset by either not spending quite so much, or you can lower the demand. Because remember, in this instance, inflation is being caused by too many people having too much money. So, and that's real demand. They have the money, they want to spend it. If we reduce their capacity to spend, then we have reduced the risk of inflation. And they could use taxes to do that. People are spending too much. Well, let's raise their taxes. We'll take some of that money and you won't be able to spend it. You know, that's one tool. It's not the only tool, which is another thing that people push back against when they realize that those who understand modern monetary theory do understand inflation. And then we utilize the three or four things that taxes are good for. And one of them is to combat inflation. They go, You think you'll be able to combat inflation through taxation? You can't get Congress to raise taxes. It's impossible. Just look at the debates that we have. Jesus Christ. No one said it was going to be easy, but that doesn't mean you don't do it. And it's also not the only tool in the toolbox. It's just one. But it is one of the reasons why we tax. First one is to drive the currency. You need it. That's the first reason. Second is to help us combat inflation. Third is to be able to help us curb or influence behavior. Let's say, for example, that we don't like smoking. Smoking places a huge, unhealthy burden upon our healthcare system. So wouldn't it be great if people were to stop smoking? Well, we can't just convince everyone to stop smoking. One thing we can do is artificially inflate the price of cigarettes. So we can place a tax. We can also use it to encourage things. You know, let's say, for example, we want everyone to have solar panels. We think it's the right thing to do for the country. It's renewable energy. It's going to help us get off fossil fuels. We will give you a tax credit. You know, we will even, the federal government can even hire an entire army of corporations to be able to build them and manufacture them and install them. Every house and every building and everyone gets a solar panel, you know, and it's free to you. And since you got a good and service that you didn't have to pay for, that's basically a tax credit, you know. So they could use that. It's finding ways to use the federal budget to get the outcome that you want. And this is one of the major insights of modern monetary theory. We need to be action-oriented. What do you want to do? That is the goal. Then you figure out, you know, how you're going to go about doing it. And then you figure out a tax scheme that allows you to do it, knowing that you don't need the taxes as revenue. You just need the tax enough to be able to make sure that people still value the currency. You need to be able to use that tax system to be able to discourage or encourage behavior, you know, because that's a good, easy way to do it. And you need to now take a look at your real resources. You have the plan. You know what you want to do. Do we have the resources to do it? If we do, production will keep up with the spending. We don't need to raise taxes to be able to afford it because we don't need to combat the inflation. But if we don't have the real resources, if the spending is now actually going to become inflationary, well, then maybe taxes will need to go up so that we can decrease the demand. But how much? This is the thing. If I needed your taxes as revenue and it's going to cost $36 trillion, I need to raise $36 trillion in taxes or borrowing to the penny. I need to be able to get that money. But if I don't need it as revenue, I create the currency. So I simply create $36 trillion and then I do a model that suggests how much is that going to impact the real economy? How much slack do we have in the real economy, real resources and labor and all these things to be able to accomplish that? Is it going to be inflationary? Well, if it is, then I can use as one tactic, a tax, to be able to lower the demand. But did I need to raise the taxes to the tune of $36 trillion? It's not a one-to-one ratio. I needed to spend $36 trillion to accomplish whatever goal, but maybe I only need to tax back $2 trillion. I just need to take the edge off. Or maybe it's $10 trillion. Who knows? But that needs to be understood. It is the final act of federal spending, not the first act. And remember, if it's not a one-to-one ratio, if I spend $36 trillion, I only need to tax back $2 trillion, is that not still a better deal? Because everyone who spends creates an economy for someone else. As Stephanie Kelton says, someone's spending is someone else's income. Same thing with the federal government. Every time the federal government spends, someone is making money somewhere. You know, every time they want to spend on war, Lockheed Martin, General Electric, these guys all make huge amounts of money. And that trickles down, you know, into their economy such that, you know, the people that work there now have a salary, they have an income, and they're going to spread that money around every time they go to the movies, every time they buy a house or a car. there's a theory of economics that's the marginal propensity to consume, MPC. What it basically means is, what is your likelihood to spend the money that comes through your fingers? If you're poor, you're likely to spend everything. Everything, down to the penny. Not because you're lazy, not because you have avarice, but because you're poor and it's expensive to live on the in this economy. You know, and call it what you will, but it takes everything that you got just to be able to make ends meet, just to be able to live in this economy. If you're fabulously wealthy, you're not really going to spend much of your income at all, you know, relatively speaking. And if you were to get more income, say in the form of a tax break, you're really not going to spend that money. You're already going out to eat as much as you're going to. You're already taking as many vacations as you're going to. You're already buying all the houses and cars you're going to. You're already having all your material needs already met. And so much so that you're taking all this extra cash that the government was just so happy to give to you, that you're now buying our democracy. You're buying our media corporations so we have fewer and fewer views expressed. You're buying our politicians so that only one side is really being seen to and everyone else is being given the middle finger. So the marginal propensity to consume is very important when you look at where do you want to spend that money. So if I spend money on a corporation, yes, you know, they're going to take some of that money and they do have people working for them and those people are going to get a salary. That's nice. But if we're talking about the ability to expand the economy, if we want to be able to end poverty, if we want to be able to end involuntary unemployment, what happens if you give all this money to the corporations in the hopes that it will trickle down and they will invest in their businesses? They're not going to do it because they understand that someone's spending is someone else's income. And if they have a business, they're not going to invest in it if they don't think there's going to be profit at the other end of that transaction. They know that they need to have a population that has disposable income and are willing to spend it. So if everyone else has had stagnant wages for 47 years and is crushed with the burden of private debt, they know that they're not going to be getting more people in the door. So why would they open up another store? Why would they hire more people? Why would they invest and build another warehouse and increase their production? There's no one buying. Trickle down doesn't work as a means of increasing GDP. Trickle up does. You give that money to the people and the people will spend. But the federal government doesn't need profit. It just needs to understand, what does it want to accomplish? Does it want to accomplish full employment, actual full employment? Everyone that wants a job gets a job. Maybe its goal is just simply to end poverty. No more poverty. You know, that means everyone that needs a job gets a job. Why? Because everyone will now have cash. No more poverty. If we spend enough, if we give them a living wage, a dignified wage, give them benefits, put them to work at the local level. The federal government is not going to run the program. The federal government simply pays the bill. The local municipalities run the program. They know what needs to get done. You walk into any town hall anywhere in the United States and you sit down with the mayor and say, look, you just tell me what your town needs. I know you're on hard times. If money were no object, what could we do? You'll never be allowed to leave the room just for the laundry list of things they will tell you, because there's going to be all manner of things that they're going to want to take care of. But they know that there's no profit at the end. They know that corporations are not going to come in and do these things. It's no profit for them. It's profit for the community, no profit for the corporations. The corporations don't do it. So who's going to do it? Because shit still needs to get done. And those people still need a paycheck to be able to do it, because no one's going to work for free. So it's got to be the federal government, the only entity that creates its own currency and can create as much of it as it needs to be able to accomplish its goals. And the only entity that needs no profit from its spending It simply needs to have a goal in mind, a mission that it must accomplish. I want to end poverty in 10 years. I want to make sure that everyone that has a healthcare need gets taken care of, and it's free at the point of service. There are no barriers of any description between you and your doctor. I want to be able to end fossil fuels, not because I hate fossil fuel companies, I personally do, but I also hate dying in a fiery ball, you know, as the planet burns. And fossil fuels and industrialized farming are the direct cause of it. So both have to change. Fossil fuels have to go away, and everything has to be green energy. And industrialized farming has to be radically changed because the model is unsustainable if we want to live. And only the federal government can do this. Only the federal government can buy out private hospitals. Only the federal government can help ExxonMobil retool to be completely 100% green energy. Do I like ExxonMobil? Do I want them to get that contract? No, I don't. But we got 12 years, according to the IPCC. And many, you know, climate scientists say we actually have far less than that. So I don't have fucking time to play favorites with people. If what it takes to get this to happen is for ExxonMobil to get the government contract, as long as we are the government, remember the Constitution says we the people, if we the people step up and be the government for once in our goddamn lives, then yes, ExxonMobil can get the contract because we will be in charge of what they do. We will be the ones to be able to say yes to this and no to that. We will be the ones. If it's business as usual.
ExxonMobil's already getting the contracts. It's already getting the money. And it's using it for various purposes.
Exactly. So, yeah, quite honestly, we're not doing anything different. We're just directing them to do what needs to get done. They will never choose to go off fossil fuels. They will never choose it. For them, a private corporation that makes no currency of its own, it has to earn or steal every dollar that flows through its greedy little fuckface hands. So they will never, of their own volition, spend the needed income to be able to retool to do what has to happen. Has to happen. It's not a choice anymore. Has to happen. But they won't do it. They are addicted to profit. They'll never do it themselves. So it has to be the federal government. And they're the only ones that can. And that's only going to work if we realize how federal finance actually works. Because the fear of our taxes having to go up, the fear of deficits and debt at the federal level, the conflation of their economy, the federal government's economy, and your economy, the conflation of the two as being the same, is what keeps people from having hope. And people that don't have hope do one of two things. One, they don't do anything. They have no hope. They're going to stay home. They'll see to their own creature comforts as best they can until they no longer have creature comforts. And then the pitchforks come out. And brother, I don't want to be around for that. That's a shit show on a galactic scale. Okay? Because anyone that studied their history realizes that when you have that type of revolution, it rarely goes well. You know, I'll give credit where credit is due and say the U.S. Revolution was actually pretty cool. It gave us the blueprint for what we could do. They fucked it up on a mighty scale. They did not emancipate women, people of color. They performed genocide on the Native Americans. There are so many places where we fell apart. But through it all, the blueprint for actual freedom is still there. We're just falling down on the job ourselves to make sure that we live up to the promises of what these things are for. We've never been a great country, ever. Not once, not for 5 seconds have we ever been a great country. But we always could have been. At every stage of the game, we could have been. And we still can. It's not too late. But if we don't act now, not likely we're ever going to get another American Revolution. It could be like the French Revolution. That shit was scary. Could be like the Russian Revolution. That shit was scary. You know, but we are still in control if we choose to be, if we want to be. And the first step in doing that is to spread hope, aspirations, and having a mechanism, a blueprint through which your aspirations can be made real. If you want Medicare for all and a Green New Deal and a federal job guarantee, if you want all these things, but you're afraid of how expensive it's going to be, and you've been convinced by someone on TV who's paid by a corporation who will lose power and market share if these things come to pass, they're paid to make you afraid. If you fall for that shit, you won't fight. And then we all die. No, but if you are actually liberated to realize that federal economics bears no resemblance to your own, then you actually have hope. There's actually a reason to believe that what you need can happen. And the only thing standing between you and it is you and the people around you. Are you going to fight for your neighbor? Are you going to fight for your community? Or are you going to be so afraid that you would actually be willing to fight for the crumbs? You are so afraid of everything we've already lost, because don't tell me we haven't. Wages have stagnated for 47 years.
And there already is a plan being implemented. That plan, though, is funneling money to the elite. Like, somebody has a plan. We just need to change up the plan.
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, MMT has been in effect, you know, since the dawning of the country and before. But when we went off the gold standard in 1971, the only people that understood that and what the ramifications are the oligarchs, the already incredibly wealthy. And they use that knowledge not to enrich the country, but to enrich themselves at all of our expenses. So MMT works.
I think, you know, it's great that people are out there talking about modern monetary theory and saying we can change the plan. The plan can actually serve people.
Absolutely.
And, you know, this crazy thing that, you know, the plan could actually be used for good.
Yeah. you don't have to change the system. You have to change the people running the system. And we have to do that. We have to be in the driver's seat. And yes, it's a representational democracy, but it's not supposed to be a good gig going to Congress. It's supposed to be hard. You're supposed to be a public servant, and we're supposed to treat them like that. You know, so if we want the things that we want, if we want to be able to live, we have to get involved. And I don't know of any other way to do it, to motivate people, to give them the reason to do it, than to give them the idea that it is possible. And it is possible to do it now, not incrementally, now.
And without that optimism, I think it is so easy for people to just tune out and,
of course,
there's nothing I can do. So that optimism, you know, it's a question I ask people on the show quite a bit of, do you consider yourself an optimist? Everyone that's talking about different theories of, mm-hmm. you know, how to solve problems in the world. And most people don't consider themselves an optimist. They, you know, do not have a very optimistic outlook on the future. And I think that's why it is so important to have discussions like this about MMT. Mm-hmm. A, just to show that what you're thinking is wrong. you know that you're wrong occasionally.
Yeah.
You know, if you have something that's wrong that you're thinking and it's hurting you, it's good to stop having those thoughts.
Absolutely. You know, one of the first things they say, if you're digging yourself deeper, first things first, stop digging.
Right.
You know, stop digging. You know, I mean, am I an optimist? I don't know. I'm Jeff. You know, I believe in love. You know, love is my God. You know, love is the one that I pray to. And sometimes that means getting angry. Sometimes that means getting a pitchfork, you know, because the things that you love are very much in danger, you know. And there's, when you realize that there's not only no reason for it, no good reason for it, but there's every opportunity economically to change everything around. You know, we can end poverty. We can end, you know, needless death. You know, we can absolutely end all of that. And through all that, all of the social ills that come with that, with crime and domestic abuse, and yes, even things as horrible as racism, you know, all the things that, you know, are either the direct result of these, you know, policies that we put into place, or are pouring gasoline onto them. No, we're never going to get rid of racism by utilizing a Green New Deal and using MMT knowledge to be able to get us, you know, jobs forever. We're not going to eliminate it. But poverty, unemployment, economic scarcity and desperation pour gasoline on racism, on sexism, on ageism, on xenophobia. You know, we're never going to get rid of these things. But if doing anything about them is a goal, and it should be, you're never going to do it if you don't eliminate poverty, if you don't eliminate economic desperation. We could get Medicare for all for everyone. We can get a job for everyone that wants one. We can end poverty. But we have to decide to do it. And if you are on gold standard thinking, where the federal government has to tax and borrow to be able to accomplish things, you're never going to get there. If it was ever going to happen in 47 years, it would have happened already. But it hasn't. Things have gotten worse. You know, there's only one way forward. And you have to understand how the federal government actually finances its spending. And then use that knowledge to enact policies that will actually save people. And the people know what they want. 70% of the population want Medicare for all. More people are in favor of taxing the rich. I just say, don't tax the rich as revenue. We don't need it as revenue. You need it to save our democracy. After they've accumulated so much wealth, they then start using that excess wealth to destroy democracy. And that's unhealthy. We need to be able to institute antitrust laws like we used to. You know, we need to be able to institute all manner of things that the oligarchs have successfully dismantled. And we accepted it. We accepted it because we accepted the premise, the notion that government was not the solution to your problem. Government was the problem. Because what happens when government provides all these things free for you? That's something that a private corporation could be doing for profit. And they like doing things for profit. And quite honestly, if you want to sell me a car, you want to sell me a phone, you want to sell me something that I don't need, fair enough. Make profit. I got nothing against that. What I hate is unregulated capitalism. What I hate is having a market that is not free, where we have economic institutions of oppression to make sure that only those who have already succeeded get a seat at the table and everyone else gets told to fuck off. You know, you can have a great idea, but you're dirt poor and you have no means of entry into the marketplace, or at least they make it incredibly difficult. You know, that has to end. But if the issue at hand is life or death, like education, like healthcare, you know, like unemployment and poverty, these things should have no place in the quote-unquote free market. Your free market solution is anathema to the health and safety of the planet. So there are some aspects of our economy that must be have a firewall. The wall that we need is not between Mexico and the U.S. The wall we need is between the oligarchs and us. So.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being here tonight. It's been a great conversation. I hope you have brought a little bit of hope to people that are, you know, listening to this.
And I hope so.
You know, that knowledge is a power, and you're giving people power, and people are the ones that need the power. So I want to thank you so much for being here tonight.
It's my pleasure. I'm sure you'll only be able to use about 20 minutes of what we just did. maybe it'll be several shows.
I want to thank you so much for joining us again. Hopefully you did get something good out of this. Hopefully you learned something, and there's a little piece of you that maybe feels a little bit lighter knowing there is a chance that things can change, that we can move things forward. We appreciate you listening to us. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, that we're not your traditional media source here. We are an activist community. We are a voice for the activist community. And we take no corporate money here. So we're not trying to sell you fear. We're trying to sell you a little bit of hope and a little bit of encouragement to change. And that's why we do have to occasionally ask you for contributions. Even if it's just a couple of dollars a month, we really appreciate it because it helps us get out to new places and cover new stories, to highlight new activists, to highlight different kinds of thinking that you're not going to hear on the mainstream media. So even if it's just the littlest bit, go on to that, click on that contribute button, and, you know, $5 a month helps us budget. If you can give more, that's great. But whatever you can do, and we appreciate everything, even when you just share our stuff around, even if you can't contribute, help us grow this network. The future is yours to create. Go out there and create it.